We're back from holiday break. It's the Velo News Podcast. I'm Fred Dreyer, Editor-in-Chief of Velo News. I'm joined today by Kaylee Fretz and Spencer Paulison. And guys, we're back from break, and luckily nothing exciting happened in the world of cycling over the last 2 weeks, which is why I figured we'd just kind of spend today's episode, I don't know, talking about what we did on our holiday breaks. You know, I did some light reading, cleaned up the... Oh, wait. Getting some news here. Oh, shoot. Turns out lots of stuff happened in the world of pro cycling over the last 2 weeks.
Always when we're gone.
Oh, my gosh. Come on, pro cycling. Didn't you know that we were too busy, like, skiing and cleaning out our garages? You should have, like, taken the holiday off, too.
No respect at all for our holiday.
No, not at all.
We had non-denominational, gender-neutral.
Yeah. Yes. Well, this is Boulder, Colorado, so it was a...
Winter celebration.
Winter festival break.
Yes. Yes.
Non-denominational, gender-neutral break.
An observance of... December.
Yeah. Observance of your December break. So what do we got going on, guys? We got Bradley Wiggins. He is actually retired for good this time.
And he's going to... Maybe.
Maybe. I know. He's going to be on some weird British reality show where he's going to be ski jumping or something like that. Marianne Vos, she's back to winning cyclocross World Cups. Good to see her back. The Tour of Qatar is not back. In fact, it is gone. Gone for good. We got to see the Paris-Nice route. I think it's going to be a cold one. And, you know, basically, other than that, it was just us cleaning out our garages and going skiing.
I slow roasted a piece of tofu.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Oh, so
a whole
good.
Day to slow roast that thing.
What did you give your dog for non-denominational holiday celebration?
You know, some Patagonia apparel. Mm. Pretty standard Boulder gift.
My cat got a vest. And a ball full of catnip and as high as a kite for like 3 days.
We should all be so lucky. Well, guys, let's get into it. We have just been out and about, not in the office for the last 2 weeks. And we're back and we're trying to catch up on things. So let's run down the ticker here. I think the first point of order piece of news we need to talk about is Bradley Wiggins announcing his sudden retirement via Instagram. I mean, that's a pretty
welcome good... to the modern era.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like if you're going to use a social media channel to retire, the gram is the way to go.
I would have gone with Snapchat, I think. That way he can go back on it and decide not to retire. It's just, it'll disappear after 24 hours.
That never happened.
That's true, but you can like record a video, I guess, like that everyone will see on the gram and link directly to Facebook so that people may think it's fake news.
Mm.
Fake news alert. Bradley Wiggins not unretiring from not racing pro cycling.
Fred, I noticed you're updating your MySpace page this weekend. That looks nice.
So what are some takes here on Wiggins retiring before we get to the fact that he's going to be on this reality show? Anyone have any takes on just like the way Wiggins went about doing it?
Well, I just spent the whole year retiring, which is what it makes me not really want to believe him that he's actually going to be gone because he announced his retirement around the same time last year, if I remember correctly, and then raced. What, California? I saw him in Dubai. Obviously went to the Olympics. It's not exactly retirement. Mm.
I liked how his retirement Instagram was a photo of a bunch of his jerseys from all of his victories. Who does that remind you of? I feel like some really prominent cyclist from the past posted a lot of jerseys.
Was he kicked back on a couch just hard chilling? Just chilling hard?
And the jerseys were sort of like framed or...
Yeah.
I don't know. It's probably nothing.
You're right, Spencer.
Probably nothing.
That cyclist was Phil Guymon.
So, who also just retired. Actually, that was also news, I guess. He rode. What's that? What's the climb in Hawaii?
Mauna.
He rode all of them, I think.
Yeah. But he did. He broke the Strava record on one of them by like 2 hours.
Let's get a little saber. Last day. Get a little saber metrics here. Pull up Strava. See what he's doing. He did the Mauna Kea. Sea to Sky is what I guess they call this.
Tops out like near 14,000 feet. It's like 0 to 14,000.
You want to talk about a horrible Strava segment? This one was, he did it in 4 hours, 50 minutes. And the guy he beat who had it before him did it in 6:44.
So 2 hours.
Ooh. He crushed him.
I don't know if that one's falling anytime soon.
The top of that one is dirt. Apparently people switch to a mountain bike halfway up sometimes.
That's 269 watts average. For about 5 hours. That sounds awful.
Yeah, but he's a day jobber now.
A lot better things to do in Hawaii.
I don't know if them Strava segments are going to continue into fall. He's a day jobber now.
No, it's true.
Or maybe breaking Strava segments is his day job. Let's get back to Wiggo, though, guys.
Yes.
So after it was announced that he was retiring, some new news came down the pike, which is that Bradley Wiggins is going to appear on the British reality show called The Jump, which has celebrities participate in really dangerous-looking wintertime Olympic sports events like downhill skiing, ski jumping, ice dancing, and
bobsledding,
the skeleton.
Yep.
So the fact that Wiggins is trading a traditional timed sport, strength-based sport, for one that like pushes the fear factor.
He's doing ski jumping, by the way.
He's doing ski jumping, which, you know, there's part of me that really wants to see Bradley Wiggins just biff it on a ski jump over and over again.
I mean, so The Jump, which is the show, I sent a little tweet out to our British fans because obviously we've never seen this show. It's not on the air in America. They said that the term celebrity is used quite loosely on The Jump, and that last season saw a lot of broken bones.
Do you think they'd invite celebrity podcasters?
Like us?
No, we're not celebrities.
I think we're only if they're British.
I think we're about as celebrity as most of their celebrities.
You have to
actually
speak the Queen's English, I think, to get on that show.
Anyway, it kind of strikes me as an odd decision because, first of all, he has a huge chance of being injured. He's not a ski jumper. He is a skier, but he's not a ski jumper. There was a bunch of broken bones last year. You know, people going to the hospital. That was kind of the most exciting part of the entire show. It seems to me like there would be better ways, more effective ways to cash in on his current celebrity than ski jumping.
There was part of me that wanted, you know, all right, if Wiggo's going to go the reality show route, I was like, well, why doesn't he do some of the more popular formats like a Dancing with the Stars format or something like a Celebrity Apprentice? I would love to see Bradley Wiggins like trying to do some sort of like team building exercise with a bunch of like spoiled British tabloid celebrities, you know, having to like put together a bicycle or like sell widgets on the side of the street corner. So it is odd that he's going for one that could legitimately injure him, which leads me to believe that maybe this retirement really is for good.
Could be.
He's like, I'm going to go out with a bang. And by bang, I mean a crack of my bones against snow.
As long as he doesn't do that naked survivor thing, then I'm totally cool with whatever
he says.
Naked and
afraid?
Yeah.
He has to like catch an eel, cook it. I'd be down to see that.
I got a little fact check for you guys here. Our fact checker, office fact checker, Vince, he stopped by the booth here. He gave me some facts. There have only been 5 recorded cases of doping in ski jumping.
Mm.
Just FYI.
Wow.
3 of those cases were for ostensibly recreational drugs, amphetamine, marijuana, and cocaine.
Very nice.
So I'm just throwing that out there. I just got some facts. Got to keep you guys, you know, in the loop on our facts.
My hottest of hot takes.
Okay.
He's going to go off the ski jump. He's going to tear his ACL. He's going to get put on a spin bike for rehab, fall back in love with the bicycle, and win the 2017 Tour de France.
Cinderella story.
Yep.
Maybe 2018. I don't know.
Maybe the Vuelta.
I'd love to see that. That would be cool. Come back, Wiggo. You're an entertainer. You're a personality.
He's only 36 years old. He's like 2 decades younger than Chris Horner, and he should just stay. We like him. As sort of irritating as Wiggo can be sometimes to the press, I think we will all be sad that he is gone. Honestly.
He's a character. You love characters. Yeah. Everybody loves characters. You love to hate them. You love to love them. You know, they don't boo nobodies.
Okay, hottest take then. Wiggo, take your break from cycling. Go break your leg, ski jumping. Go maybe dance on TV and then fall back in love with cycling as you're rehabbing your injuries from being a celebrity ski jumper.
Perfect.
Wow.
Moving on. Marianne Vos. She is one of our favorite cyclists, male or female. She's won everything. She was not winning everything for a long time. And then, bam, Zolder World Cup cyclocross. Vos comes out on top ahead of Sana Kant and Katarina Nash. Kaylee, you got any takes on Marianne Vos being back? Is she back with a capital B?
I think she is. I think she's back with a capital B. And I think my only real take there is stoked. I think that it's really good for cross. I think it's going to be really, really good this spring. I think that's sort of the broader picture here. This suggests that she's back on the form that she used to have, which was sort of world-dominating form. And in that one-month span, sort of early March to late April, which is really the crux of the women's season at this point, that women's classic season, I think it's going to be much, much better with Vos in the mix.
I agree with Kaylee. And I would go so far as to say that women's pro road racing needs Marianne Vos way more than pro cyclocross racing. In the past 6 World Cups we've had this season, we've had 6 different winners in that women's elite field. So it's a deep field. It's a talented field. It's great to have Vos there. I'll say I want to go on record calling her to win cross worlds. Just right here, right now, I'm going to say that. And but the thing about road, the road season, the world, the women's world tour is it's all Bulls Dolman. Last season, for sure, it was 10 out of the 17 women's world tour races were won by Bulls riders, and you get Mariana Voss in the mix with her WM3 Energy team, new team coming out of the Rabo Live program that has shut down. I think it could really spice it up. Plus, you got Pauline Ferrand-Prevot riding for Canyon SRAM, and hopefully that will be her way to reinvigorate her career.
Yeah, I mean, I think the key to an exciting women's classic season this year is going to be breaking up that Bulls domination. And so Voss, in particular, coming back, if we get PFP, we're not actually sure if PFP is going to be back this year to her old powers. If those two are back, that's the number one way to break up that domination.
And, I got a new lingo like here. New lingo here. Bulls domination. Dominating.
Oh, wow. Spencer always providing me with opportunities to use that little
I had to jump in on that one. I'm sorry.
No, I appreciate your funny punniness. You know, we appreciate you, Spencer. I'm really psyched to see Mariana Voss back, even if it is just for cyclocross. You know, this year in men's cyclocross racing, it's just been all about two guys, Matthew Vanderpool and
Wout van Aert.
And I know I can never pronounce Woot. I'm always like Woot. Wout.
I think it's Wout. I think it's actually Wout.
Wout van Aert. And like
you got to watch the SRAM video, the where he's trying to explain to everyone in the SRAM office how to pronounce his name. It's pretty funny.
Woot. What?
What? Woot.
Either way, you know, women's cyclocross to me is always so much more entertaining. I think back to, you know, 6-7 years ago when you had just a number of women who were winning the World Cups. Daphne Van der Brand, Kitty Compton, Hanka Kupfer-Nagel, Katarina Nash, PFP, Helen Wyman, and Mariana Voss. And this year, it seems like we have this similarly deep field. I mean, it, depending on the course and depending on the conditions, anyone can win. So you throw Mariana Voss in there, and I don't know, it's just, she's the straw that stirs the drink, as they say. You know, personally, I'd love to see Katarina Nash win Worlds. She won a World Cup, what was it, 3 weeks ago, and just made me bonkers with delight because she's such a fun rider to watch.
She's the best.
I think Voss coming back, I'm with you, Spencer. I think she's now the odds-on favorite. And whether that's to win Worlds, and whether that is a bellwether for having early season road success, you know, it's tough to say. Like, Bulls Dolmans, they do have those fast finishers, but I feel like so much of what makes that team strong is the fact that
They have numbers. Yeah.
So as much as I want to see Mariana Voss come back and be able to win some of those races, I still think she faces an uphill battle there because I don't know if she necessarily has the numbers quite yet. Moving on, we got to see the route for Paris-Nice. And, you know, Paris-Nice is always kind of a roll of the dice from a weather perspective because it's early. They hit some high altitudes. They started in the north of France. This one, Kaylee, seems like they are gambling with Mother Nature because there are a couple of trips high, high, high into the air.
Yeah, so, you know, it covers the sort of the normal southeasterly course, right? Paris to Nice, that's in the title. The difference this year is that they go the highest the race has ever gone, 5,500 feet. And they go past at least two ski resorts on course. I was just sort of cruising through the route this morning and spotted at least two. So if not more, that's a bold play in early March, riding past ski resorts. So I think there's a pretty good chance that we see the extreme weather protocol enacted this year at Paris-Nice, much like it was at Tirreno last year, where they lopped off essentially the queen stage. If that doesn't happen, then Paris-Nice this year is most certainly a race for the climbers, which I think is pretty exciting. There's two different uphill finishes. The time trial has an uphill finish. It's going to be a really, really tough race, provided the weather cooperates.
Question. All right, let's get in our crystal balls. Let's look at a scenario in which it's snowing, the weather is bad, we are watching on our computers, giving our computers viruses from the illegal feeds that we are watching through.
No, this one's on NBC Sports.
Okay, never mind. Yeah, we're watching on NBC on Sports Gold. What's going to be your mood when all the riders start like chirping away on Twitter about how it's unsafe and how they need to, you know, get rid of this summit finish? Are you going to be a good cycling fan and say, okay, riders, I agree with you? Or are you going to, you know, vociferously tweet angry things at them saying, oh, come on, NFL plays through snow.
I'm a professional, Fred. Okay. And so I will play it right down the middle. You know, I'll just be completely, you know, nonpartisan, No, I think we could do an entire podcast about this, actually. I think we could, the extreme weather protocol stuff, you know, we have people tweet at us all the time, oh, that's the wussification of pro cycling.
That's right.
We should go back, you know, we have a picture hanging downstairs at Velen's here of the Badger. I think it was in Liège in the snow, you know, back in the good old days. I don't think he was ever
the same after that race, though.
His fingers don't work anymore. Yeah. There's a reason for these things.
I think he won that race by 4 hours.
Yep.
Yeah, that was classic Bernard Hinault. But for me, the top priority is, if they are going to tweet about the weather and complain about the weather and all this stuff, make it funny so that we can repurpose those tweets on the website.
Call.
Because then we'll have fun content, and it keeps adding flavor to the pro cycling peloton. The other thing I'll say about Paris-Nice, this is not going to be, I think, a repeat of Tirreno Adriatico last year, which saw Greg Van Avermaet win the overall. Total surprise, because they had to cancel the mountain stage. Because, like Kaylee said, this time trial, this stage 4 time trial, you've got about 3 kilometers of climbing at the end. And it's going to be the GC guy who ends up winning with that kind of climb at the end. And generally speaking, I'm not really a huge fan of having time trials like that. If it just ends up being a climber's time trial, sort of what's the point there? Let's stick to a more traditional flat time trial that favors pure time
trials. I do think it'll be pretty tight. It's only 15 kilometers. Yes, the end is steep, but I think we'll come into those last 2 uphill finishes, you know, with about a minute gap maximum at the front end of the field. And then you have that stage 8, which is... Looking ahead to the Tour de France, it's sort of in the style of that post stage. It's only 115 kilometers. It's got 5 categorized climbs in it. It's up in and around Nice. We've seen that last stage be a bit chaotic.
It was great last
2 years.
Yeah, it was great. I remember watching last year.
Last 2 years has been fantastic.
Yeah.
I think that, so even if we come into the last stage with a bit of a gap to the leader, anything can happen. I think it should be a pretty good race. The question is always, where do riders go? Do they go to Tirreno or do they go to Paris-Nice? I know most of the guys haven't even picked yet. I was on the phone with Jonathan Vaughters over the weekend. I know for a fact that guys like Andrew Talansky have not picked which of those 2 races they'll do yet. Some of it might depend on the weather.
The 2017 Tirreno, I think it's pretty similar. You've got a team time trial. You've got an individual time trial. The individual time trial is short, and they are climbing. They're doing a pretty major climb midway through, which...
Do we think the presence of these high-altitude climbs at Paris-Nice, given the chance there could be snow and ice and, you know, general misery, do we think that attracts more or fewer Tour hopefuls than in years past?
The Tour hopefuls have tended toward Tirreno because it tended to be slightly warmer in the last couple of years, although there's always a bit of a mix on either side. Tirreno was so miserable last year, maybe guys go back towards Paris-Nice, but I think those high altitude finishes, those high altitude rides might scare some guys away.
I feel like sometimes it depends on a rider's preference toward more French races versus more Italian races, because certainly having Paris-Nice promoted by the ASO, Tirreno promoted by RCS, they kind of mimic the Giro and the Tour de France in terms of the overall route and vibe and everything. And certainly they do a little bit of previewing for particular parts of those races from time to time. And, you know, you get some of the well-known climbs that are often included in those Grand Tours. For instance, stage 4 of this year's Tirreno is going up the Terminello, which
right.
is going to be really the queen stage. That'll be the major climb. And hopefully they can race it this year, unlike last year's queen stage.
Fingers crossed.
Okay. Well, if it starts snowing and they start canceling stages, I will write mean tweets into my drafts and then not send them. How about that?
I got a big pile of drafts right now.
Okay.
Yeah. Is that part of your New Year's resolution, Fred, not to mean tweet people anymore?
Yeah, basically just to like retweet kind of ridiculous bicycling magazine story tweets, which are pretty funny.
I did see that.
Are you messing up your eggs?
I did see that.
And I was like, hey, man, lay off my eggs. All right.
Yeah.
I make my eggs the way I want to make my eggs.
It's a lifestyle choice.
Real
personal
runny.
Personal lifestyle
Real
choice.
Real runny. Okay, moving on. Last topic of the day. Man, the Tour of Qatar is dead. Bury it in the sand. We found out a week ago that Tour of Qatar, owned by the ASO, was having sponsorship problems. I don't know how you have sponsorship problems when you don't really have any sponsors historically. But anyway, they've decided to can both the men's and the women's race. Men's race started in 2002. Women's race started in 2009. Now there's a big gaping hole in the early January, February season, and riders will no longer be racing around in that sandy wasteland, providing us with awesome shots of echelons.
I kind of like the Tour of Qatar. actually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As a reporter, let's hear why you like
it. Okay, so Worlds this year was all right. But the Tour of Qatar has historically gone out into the desert more, mm-hmm. and we get a lot of wind, we get a lot of crosswinds. My favorite example is the year that Brent Bookwalter won that race. That's a little bit strange, you know? You wouldn't really think that Brent would be the kind of guy for the Tour of Qatar. But he was, and that's because that race is super unpredictable. The riders like it, too, because it's nice and warm down there. They get some really, really good racing. It's very, very hard racing, and they like that coming into the classics season. So, you know, I'm bummed it's gone. I think that Dubai, Qatar, Oman group down there in the middle of winter was actually quite nice. I'll still be going to Dubai this year, reporting from Dubai. I think we still have Gregor Brown going to Oman, so we'll still cover those races. But it is a bummer that we don't have Qatar, which I honestly think was probably the best of the three bike races.
Well, and as a journalist, it was always easy. You know, you could just go grab some of the stars of the sport as they were like hanging out in some empty nondescript parking lot, which totally. Is where the stages would start. Yeah, there'd be no fans.
From a professional standpoint, I always love Dubai because we stay in a very nice hotel and the start and finish, or at least the starts are in the exact same place every day, and we just go down and the dudes are hanging out. They're all in a good mood. You know, they just finished their holidays. They're just chilling. It's nice and warm. They're not trying to train in France or somewhere else cold.
Yep.
You get a lot of shirtless post-race shots, some photos too, which I think is nice.
Yeah, I went swimming with John Degenkolb one year.
So the interesting thing here is that Qatar, Dubai, you know, none of these races have really made a ton of financial sense in that, you know, you're not getting lots and lots of fans. You're not generating a huge television audience. The sponsors aren't exactly lining up to fund these races. A lot of times, the big sponsors have come from government agencies. It has seemed like these races are being underwritten by the governments of these countries. And the thing is that, you know, these countries are so dependent on the price of oil, and the price of oil has plummeted since 2014. So, you know, Qatar, for example, is committed to putting on the 2022 World Cup. It's putting billions and billions of dollars into these stadiums. And I wonder if part of the calculus here is that, you know, the price of energy is dropping globally. Qatar is still committed to putting on the World Cup. Maybe the Tour of Qatar is a casualty of that. You know, the state government is just looking at its expenditures and saying, okay, maybe, you know, a multiple day long bike race that costs us millions and millions of dollars, just, you know, we got to cut something, and that's what's getting the snip.
You know, Fred, that's a very nice, educated, and well thought out take, but I'm going to have to say, as far as I can tell, this all comes down to a lack of respect between Uh-oh. The cyclists and the organizers. If you go back to last year, you'll remember that Tour of Qatar, they told Etix Quickstep that they just couldn't come to the race. Mm-hmm. They said, nope, you can't come. And I'll tell you what the Sheikh Khalid bin Ali Al Thani said back then was, they take too much time changing their shoes, sitting around, and then meeting the press while they keep us waiting. They can't do that. There were some problems with hotels, discipline, things. This sheik was not happy at all with Etix Quickstep, and I can almost guarantee you that the rest of these cyclists with their stupid shoes and waiting around and drinking their coffee and goofing off, they displeased the sheik and the royal family. Wait. And that was all it took for the Qatar royal family to say, no more cycling in our country.
Wait, tech news. Maybe some shoe company is going to invent a quicker shoe that will bring the Tour of Qatar back.
It would be cool if it was like
shoes.
A triathlete
shoe. Yeah,
like
a Velcro strap. Yep. Oh, people have been doing that for a while.
Okay.
So the real reason there is hidden in that quote, which is the hotel thing. There are some things. Stories, which I'm not sure I can repeat in public because I have not confirmed them independently, but there were some
shenanigans?
Hotel shenanigans that happened with the team that was not invited back. I will leave it at that.
So I think that they are going to invest their sporting infrastructure into maybe a bridge card championship or some sort of chess tournament. Something a little lower key with less attitude.
Something where the athletes are a little bit better behaved and wear quicker clothing. Clothing that's quicker to get in and out of.
Swimming, maybe. Mm. There's a lot of water there.
Tour of Qatar, we will miss you. As endurance athletes, we are accustomed to
thinking that we're in tip-top shape, that we are supermen whose bodies will overcome all the stresses we put into them, like riding up the sides of mountains. That isn't always the case. In fact, as it turns out, endurance sports can actually have negative impacts on our bodies, specifically our heart. I'm joined today by Chris Case and Leonard Zinn, who have been working on a project over the last few years about the relationship between endurance sports and heart problems. In 2014, they published the story Cycling to Extremes, which explored the relationship between endurance sports and heart problems. And just this year, a couple weeks ago, they published their first book. It's called The Haywire Heart: How Too Much Exercise Can Kill You and What You Can Do to Protect Your Heart. Chris Case, Leonard Zinn, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So I figured a good place to start off with this is, Leonard, if you could tell the listeners about how you yourself started having heart problems. You are a lifelong endurance athlete, and it sounds like it was 2013 that you started to have problems with your ticker.
Yeah, it was a beautiful morning in late July. I was riding up the mountain right behind Boulder, which any cyclist here in Boulder has ridden 1,000 times, and I was going hard up it, and I'm so used to that climb that I know that I was going well, and then I felt a weird kind of thump in my chest, and then just happened to glance down at my Garmin, which was reading off my heart rate, and saw that it had just been at 150, because I just looked at it seconds before, and now it said 218. And I just figured something was wrong with it, you know, and just kind of ignored it, kept riding. But I'd keep glancing at it, and it stayed up there at 218. And then finally, after 7 minutes of that, I thought, well, maybe this isn't the greatest idea to keep going. So I stopped and then immediately came back down, and I, of course, was immediately regretted having blown a really good time that I was going to get up the mountain, and that started the whole process for me. I mean, at that point, I didn't think anything was wrong. I went ahead and I went after another Strava KOM, and I did intervals in another canyon nearby, and late in the day, I called my doctor and said, hey, I had this weird thing happen. Could you give me a recommendation for a cardiologist? They said, you need to go to the ER. I went to the ER, and then the doctor who was in the ER at the time was the team doctor for the Garmin Sharp team, and he had lots of experience with cyclists. He, based on my blood test, he said, you need to go to the downtown cardiac unit, and you can't have your wife take you. You got to go in an ambulance. I'm like, what? You know, but fortunately, because he was really into cycling and new pro cyclists and how their bodies respond, I took his advice and I did that. And then, you know, then since then, I've learned more and more about it. In the hospital, they did a bunch of tests and showed that all my plumbing was perfect. They did what's called an angiogram and looked inside, and that it's just strictly an electrical problem. And since then, I've learned a lot about that.
Chris, what was going on? What was going on with LZ's ticker?
Well, it was a long process for him to figure that out, working with a lot of doctors, a lot of electrophysiologists. It relates to, you know, he mentioned the plumbing. Mm-hmm. There's plumbing, arteries, veins, blood. That's your plumbing in your heart. And then there's the electrical system, which it's a little more complicated. You get into ions and ion channels inside the heart that are conducting electricity through your heart and making it beat in a synchronous way. And all the chambers have their function, and they have to beat in a rhythmic way. If they don't, you have an arrhythmia. And his happens to be multifocal tachycardia, atrial tachycardia. And so there's a lot of different arrhythmias out there. His is one in which his atria is prone to this elevated heart rate, elevated rate. So he could tell you a little bit more about how that's affected his life. I can tell you from knowing him and seeing the changes in him that it was a process. You know, first there was the denial stage, and then there was the
the depression phase, I think, and maybe a little bit of guilt. Like a lot of athletes do this for so many years, and like you said, like you introduced the piece, we think that we're doing something great for our bodies, but sometimes maybe we cross a line and we overdo it, and then you think to yourself, well, wow, did I do this to myself? I think to bring us back, we talked, and he started talking with a lot of his friends from his past that raced with him on bikes or that skied with him, cross-country skied with him throughout the years, and he started to realize that there were a lot of his friends out there that were also having heart problems. And that's when we decided to write that article, and we did that with Dr. Mandrola from Louisville, Kentucky, and he's the third author on the book, and it went from there.
Leonard, what type of stories were you hearing from some of your friends who were also, you know, late 40s, early 50s, people who had basically spent their entire lives doing endurance sports? What type of stories were you hearing from them?
Well, it ran the gamut from friends or acquaintances of mine from cross-country skiing who had either died or gone into sudden cardiac death or sudden cardiac arrest where they had to be paddled out of it, and that they would have died had they not had either a combination of being frozen down in the snow so that they weren't doing damage to their brain and stuff by not having much blood flow or any blood flow, and then getting shocked out of it or having it happen right near where there was somebody with a defibrillator who could defibrillate them. So that's the more extreme end. And then to the other end of most common arrhythmia, at least seems to be among endurance athletes, is called atrial fibrillation, where the upper chambers of the heart, the atria, move in a disorganized and very rapid way. And so I found out that I had dozens and dozens and dozens of friends that I had both cross-country ski raced with and bike raced with who had that, and then lots of other things, you know. Oh yeah, well, I've got a bovine valve in my heart, you know, replaced with a cow valve, and I've got a, you know, and I've got, and you know, other friends would have, I'm on beta blockers, and yeah, I had a mild heart attack, right? You know, lots of stuff, and I was
ablations.
So ablations are where when you have an arrhythmia, where the doctor goes in inside your heart with a catheter, and locates the area where the current is running where it shouldn't be, and burns it up with either radio frequency or freezes it with cryogenically and kills the cells in that area so that current can't flow through there anymore. And so, yeah, I was amazed how many people I was racing with who were still racing who'd had ablations to fix their arrhythmias.
So in a broad sense, guys, what is going on here? Obviously, you know, you said it is a problem not with plumbing but with the electrical side. How is a lifelong of endurance sports contributing to these electrical problems? Like what is the mechanism by which, you know, being a person that has a regular elevated heart rate, you know, leads to problems later in life?
Well, when you exercise hard, you create some tissue damage. You're aware of that when you're in your muscles. You can feel the sore muscles after a hard workout, and that you know that you're going to come back stronger from it. That's why you do it. And that process is an inflammatory process. Your body, inflammation is when the body responds by pouring white blood cells in to repair damage, and when it happens in the heart, similar kind of thing happens as in other muscles where yes, they can be repaired easily enough, but sometimes they can develop scar tissue. And when you have a little bit of scarring in the heart, then you don't have the electrical current doesn't move through it the way it did before. It's like a rock in a stream, and then the stream has to part around the rock, and it may be that when it goes around the rock, then it doesn't come back to the stream that it was supposed to be in. It veers off in another weird way. And then once that that new pathway is found in the heart, your heart doesn't unfind it. It in periods of stress, it keeps finding that that, and you end up, you know, the heart will either. Generally, it's a case where it moves much faster than it otherwise did. It beats faster, and sometimes in an organized way, but usually in a more disorganized way.
And how common were you finding this to be? I mean, obviously we are now at a period in history where there are lots of people who have spent a decade or more doing endurance sports. I would imagine in the past this wasn't an issue. So we now have this cohort of lifelong endurance athletes who are entering their 50s and 60s. And I'm curious how often you're finding this occurrence, and then what type of studies have been done to try and determine how common it is.
I think the first thing to say is that
basically I want to know, I ride my bike every day, and when I turn 50, am I going to have heart problems?
I would say that the chances are relatively low that you're going to develop an arrhythmia. I mean, it's really hard to say. I think that's first thing.
Yep.
It's really hard to say the prevalence of these things. If you have a stressful life, if you're a lifelong endurance athlete and you're pushing yourself all the time and you're aging and you keep pushing yourself. And then maybe something else in your life becomes stressful. Maybe a divorce, maybe a death in the family, something like that.
Or a virus, a cold, something like that.
I would say that more than likely you're going to feel certain symptoms as pertains to your heart. Maybe those are palpitations, preventricular contractions or preatrial contractions, PVCs or PACs, you might hear people refer to them as. But a little flutter, a little skipped, some people, you know, call them a skipped heartbeat. A lot of people feel those. Even younger endurance athletes will feel those. Most times, those are completely benign. There are things that an athlete's heart does and how an athlete's heart changes that are considered within the normal range. I think another thing to stress is that it's going to be very, very rare that you will die from an arrhythmia of any kind. I think that's fair to say. It happens, though, but we just can't say how likely it is because there's so many variables in every individual. There's genetics, there's lifestyle, there's stress levels, there's past lifestyle that affects all of these things, whether you were a smoker or overweight or just led an unhealthy life at some point. Does that thoroughly answer, satisfactorily answer the question? It's a difficult one to answer.
Well, maybe. I would assume, yeah, too, that the science is pretty new around this.
Well, the science is new. It's not like a lot of heart science that's done where you're, say, testing a different drug on the heart. Then you can have a placebo in one group and you can have the medication in another group. You can't do a double-blind study with this kind of thing because you can't hide from somebody their training load. So it's only based on very broad accumulation of data, mega data from a lot of events that people then put together and
observational in nature.
Exactly, observational in nature. So that in itself, it tells you something about the probability of something that happens, but it certainly doesn't tell you whether it's going to happen to you.
Right.
And that's the hard part. And you know, one of the things that I guess I didn't point out at the beginning, when I had my arrhythmia, I was age 55. And the people that I was racing with then were in this 55-plus age group. So those are the people I was talking to were having these issues. It's not like I'm talking with a bunch of 30-year-olds. But that I think the point is that there is this chronic inflammation going on from this continual load of exercise that's been happening. And current state of science with hearts says that it's not too much fat in your diet. It's not cholesterol. It's not caffeine. It's not a number of things that people used to think affected the heart. It's inflammation is the critical thing, and whether that's sourced in your diet or in your lifestyle can be either one. And we just know, for instance, people, there's a couple of big cross country ski races in one in Norway and one in Sweden. Each of them has 16,000 people that do the event, and there have been studies then of like up to 90,000 people who've done those events. And what we can say is there's a direct correlation between the incidence of atrial fibrillation and how many times they've done those races. Mm. The more they do the people who've done them, the more often have higher rates of atrial fibrillation. And furthermore, the people who are faster have higher rates of atrial fibrillation too. That for the person who is less serious about it and doesn't train as much at it, has a lower rate of these problems.
Yeah, listeners should know that. I mean, Leonard was an elite racer when you were, in your 20s and early 30s. When did you retire from elite racing?
Actually, very young, age 23.
23. But you've been a high-level endurance athlete your entire life. I've ridden with you. You're very fast. You can keep up. You're very strong on a bike. So, that's very interesting to me as well. What was your pathway out of this, Leonard? What type of lifestyle changes had to happen? And, what changed in your life to allow you to move beyond this?
Well, I should say, first of all, that my intention was to be able to continue to be a lifelong athlete, that I had no intention of stopping doing. I love bike riding. I love skiing. I love doing a lot of things. But moderation was key. And
it would have been key. It should have been key.
Should have been key. Now it is key. And I think probably a lot of us have had our mothers tell us, oh, don't you think you're just overdoing it? And we, of course, laugh at our mothers, like, what do they know? And it turns out maybe they knew a lot more than we thought. I used to enjoy going on 200-plus mile bike rides, 16 hours in a day on the bike and racing hard and just training hard and doing intervals. And now I basically don't do any of that. I limit my workouts to maybe 2 hours max, and I try and keep my heart rate below 135 beats a minute, because above that, there's a very high likelihood. I've just seen it happen so many times where I'll go into arrhythmia and it's not any fun. And then if it happens and you're a fairly long way from home, then it's like crawling home to get back. And once it happens, it's not like you just reset and then you can pedal the way you were before.
Yeah, Chris, what are some thoughts and advice that, you spent all this time, you guys spent this time researching this book, but what are some bits of advice to come out of it for people who suffer from this?
Yeah, what I wanted to sort of just revisit, and it dovetails with what Leonard was just saying. I wish I could give you a percentage of the number of people that have AFib, but I don't think that data point exists. It's very difficult to pinpoint that. But like Leonard was saying, regardless of the severity of the arrhythmia you develop, and as he said, AFib is one of the most common, it totally changes people's lives, it can. I spoke with a number of people to put together these case studies, and all of them went through a serious process. Sometimes breaking down into tears and just falling into acute bouts of depression, honestly, because it's going to change their lives and prevent them from doing something that they love. To a more extreme examples, when the episode or event that nearly killed them caused them much worse psychological damage and problems. But to answer your question about what people can do, they have to listen to their bodies. That's paramount in this. I think generally speaking, if you ride really hard, you want to rest equally as hard. If your training load is pretty high and then some other stress enters your life, you've got to give something up. You can't just keep piling the stressors onto yourself. So if you're training at a high level and then there is a death in the family, you've got to back off the training. You can't just keep pushing through that because the mental and physical stress will add up and something has to give. And often I think what we're seeing is that it affects through the inflammation process, it affects the heart. So there's a number of sort of warning signs that are very serious. And then there's some others that are less serious. And generally speaking, the ones that are not normal and that need immediate attention are this racing heart, like Leonard experienced, tachycardia, this elevated heart rate, any chest pressure or pain that someone's feeling. If you're experiencing labored breathing, and we're not talking about during intervals, this is just all of a sudden labored breathing, that's a very serious warning sign. And then obviously if you're fainting or coming close to fainting, that's a serious warning sign too.
And I would say that also if you are somebody who has a lot of data on yourself and you're aware of the kind of power numbers you produce or the kind of the times you do on certain ride or run or ski or whatever it is, and that you notice a considerable drop off in performance that is not explainable by that, say you're out of shape or some reason like that, that then it's time to rest. That we all know that, yes, there's the phenomenon of overtraining, but overtraining and that can cause your performance to decrease, and that we all know it's just harder to listen to that advice. We all know that what you need to do in that situation is rest. And it may also be that it's because of your heart that there's a drop off. Some of the people that we've interviewed for the case studies, that's how they discovered it, that all of a sudden their performance had just gone downhill and they didn't understand it. And it turned out that their heart wasn't functioning the way it had before.
Yeah, I think consistently low power or lower performance than you're typically experiencing or able to generate. Those palpitations I mentioned earlier, excess fatigue or excess irritability, honestly. Those are sort of those signs that are not as serious, but you definitely want to listen to your body and consider, given your age, what you should do about that. And obviously, if you're of a certain age, I think Dr. Mandrola would say anywhere above 35, honestly, consider going to see a cardiologist.
Well, guys, there's so much more to this book that we could touch on. We could talk for days and days about it, but I really recommend that VeloNews podcast listeners go check it out. It's called The Haywire Heart. It is available on Velo Press now. And to Chris Case and Leonard Zinn, thanks so much for coming in, guys.
Certainly.
Thank you.
Guys, we have a really important question to finish off today's episode with. A few weeks ago, we had the news story break about the Mystery Sky package and a lot of the tomfoolery that Sky may or may not have been doing around whether or not Brad Wiggins had a mysterious package delivered to him. And you know, the Daily Mail reporter Matt Lawton wrote a story basically saying that he sat down to an interview with David Brailsford. And during this interview, Brailsford allegedly tried to swap him a story in order to kill the story he was about to write about Wiggins and the mystery package. So my question for you is this. Let's say, hypothetically, you are seated down to an interview with David Brailsford, and he wants to trade some story with you to kill this package story. What story would you agree to trade with him in order to kill the story? What level of story? I'm going to go first. I want Brailsford to give me concrete proof that Bradley Wiggins, his tattoos are actually henna. They are painted on. And that every day, a henna artist has to sit down for painstaking work to paint on Bradley Wiggins' tattoo. I would agree to kill
the mystery package story.
That would be a scandal.
For that story.
I mean,
story.
The henna story, that would be worldwide. That would make
my career.
Yeah.
I could write like a New Yorker magazine feature
BBC
about that.
Be on the phone.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, man.
I think I have one here, Fred.
Okay.
I would trade the story if Brailsford could get me proof that the Brexit vote was rigged by a consortium of other team notables like Alexander Vinokourov and Sheikh Nasser and all these other guys. They rigged the Brexit vote in an effort to sabotage Team Sky financially so that they would finally have a chance to beat Team Sky in the Tour de France.
Right, and it would prove that cycling was actually relevant in the global scheme of things.
That would be the most shocking revelation of all.
That's true. Okay, Brexit vote, Wiggins, henna tattoos. Kaylee, what would you trade this story for?
Oh, man.
Maybe some team like is engaging in human trafficking or has like ties to ISIS or something like that. I mean, would you trade for that?
Oh,
I don't know. Mystery package is pretty juicy.
There would need to be like geopolitical overtones, I think, much like Spencer's story.
What if he leaked the winner of the Jump reality show before the final episode aired, and you were able to break the news of whether Bradley Wiggins actually won the Jump reality show, if there is such a thing as a winner of that reality show?
That'd
I don't even know.
Story. That'd be a huge. Well, I think it's whoever ends up not broken. I think that's how you win the Jump reality show.
Right. So you're saying like they tape this in advance, and then all the people that are on the show
have to
like
TV,
swear
man.
To
it's
secrecy.
Not live.
Yeah, that's true. Ooh, that would be really good.
Yeah,
it's true. It'd be a couple months.
I think these three are all good takes on what we would say, what we would look at David Brailsford and say, okay, chap, I'll hold the story.
Thanks, lads.
I think I'd want the Tour de France route for the following year so Hoodie and I could get better hotels. I think I'd totally trade for that. Purely.
It's very pragmatic. I'm still going with some pro cycling team having connections to ISIS. We would love your feedback on what we talked about today. You can email us at webletters@competitorgroup.com. We'll also post links to the stories we talked about today on velonews.com. Subscribe to the Velonews podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play. And while you're there, please leave us a comment and a rating. Please, please, please become a fan of Velonews on Facebook at facebook.com/velonewsmagazine and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/velonews. The Velonews podcast is produced by Velonews, which is owned by the Competitor Group. Thoughts and opinions expressed on the Velonews podcast are those of the individual. And as always, we leave you today with the Brooklyn Boogaloo Blowout playing Bernard Purdy classic Soul Drums.